most people would have taken that meeting. It's called opposition research, or even research into your opponent. I've had many people, I have only been in politics for 2 years, but I've had many people call up, oh, gee, we have information on this factor or this person or, frankly, Hillary. That's very standard in politics. Politics is not the nicest business in the world, but it's very standard where they have information and you take the information.
President Trump in Paris today answering a question about his son's meeting with a lawyer connected to the Russian government. Trump is in Paris getting ready to mark Bastille Day with French President Emmanuel Macron. Meanwhile, in Washington, Senate Republicans unveiled their revised health care bill. It has a few changes, but like the earlier versions, it is not friendly to Medicaid. That's the government program that pays for care for the poorest Americans. There is also a new lawsuit involving California's Medicaid program, known as Medi-Cal. It says the program is guilty of racial discrimination. Let's talk about that with Saumya Carla Mendoza. She covers health and health policy for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's start with the new bill in the Senate. What's changed? Is this version any likely, or more likely, I should say, to get to the floor for a vote?
So this is a new version. It's not really that new. There are a couple of changes. It would preserve two taxes on higher-income Americans that the previous version was going to undo. It would give $45 billion extra for the opioid epidemic. It would allow people to use health savings accounts a little bit easier, but it doesn't really make any big changes that would make it dramatically more likely for the bill to come to a vote. There were some concessions that were made. There was a change to allow insurance companies to offer really bare bones plans, which is something that Senator Ted Cruz wanted, but there's still a lot of conservatives who say this doesn't go far enough to repeal Obamacare. And then there are some other people who say, you know, I don't want to vote for this because it's going to gut Medicaid. And a lot of those people are Republicans, and there's opposition from Republican governors. So I think it still has a long road.
Right. Okay. So it doesn't really, it's not really any nicer, to put it in the president's words, for people on Medicaid.
Yeah, it makes almost no, I think it makes no changes to what the previous version of the bill did to Medicaid. So under the previous version of the bill, Medicaid was sort of dramatically changed. So the first part is that under the Affordable Care Act, states were allowed to expand their Medicaid programs. In California, we added 3.9 million people to Medi-Cal. That would be scaled back almost completely. And then sort of the bigger change is that since Medi-Cal or Medicaid was created in 1965, it's worked under what's called an entitlement program. So whatever bills are created by the program, the federal government will sort of reimburse no matter how big they are. And so both versions of the Senate bill would change that completely. It would cap the funding. So states would ultimately get less money to fund their programs. And in California, we would be looking at $115 million from now until 2027. I'm sorry, $115 billion from now until 2027.
Okay, so let's talk about what's happening here in California. You've written about this lawsuit filed by a group of beneficiaries, Medi-Cal beneficiaries, who are Latino. And tell us more about this case and why they are saying that it's about discrimination.
Right. So the lawsuit alleges that the payment rates to doctors are so low in Medi-Cal that people who are in Medi-Cal have a lot of trouble finding doctors. And I hear this a lot. People in Medi-Cal do have a lot of trouble finding doctors. The lawsuit goes one step further and says that because Medi-Cal is majority Latino and has become more and more Latino in the recent years, and payment rates have gone down in recent years, that the state has essentially set up a system in which they're discriminating against Latinos. So the lawsuit says that the state has an obligation to provide medical care to people in Medi-Cal that's equivalent to what people get in private insurance and Medicare. And because those programs are tend to be majority white, you now have these majority white programs where there are better care than in the majority Latino program, which is Medi-Cal.
And are they also saying that when there were more white people in the program, reimbursement rates were higher?
Yes, they are saying that. And reimbursement rates were cut during the recession, and the percentage of Latinos in the program has just, you know, increased sort of steadily year by year.
And what does the state say?
So the state says that they're monitoring, you know, the Medi-Cal system. They say there are no systematic issues. And that's basically it. They say they just sort of say that, you know, they're keeping an eye on what's going on. They monitor to make sure there are enough doctors. And Things are going pretty smoothly.
Well, is that true? We have heard, as you say, anecdotally, a lot of horror stories about people who can't, see a doctor just for a basic checkup.
Yeah, it's hard to know on a wide scale. I mean, I also hear those sorts of stories all the time, but there are 13.5 million or 13.7 million people in Medi-Cal. And so it is possible that, the majority of them are doing just fine. And we're hearing from an angry few.
Mm-hmm. And one of those is a woman that you profile. Her name is Esther Castaneda, who had to go to Mexico for surgery because she just couldn't find care here.
Yeah. So she's one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. So she's a 56-year-old woman who lives in Sacramento, and she needed a routine gallbladder surgery, and that was diagnosed by a primary care doctor. And she just couldn't get the referral to go to the specialist to get the surgery. It kept getting denied. Specialists said they didn't take Medi-Cal. She was in pain all the time. She was vomiting. She stopped eating because it made the pain worse. And so eventually, when she was on vacation in Mexico and the pain was so bad, she just got the surgery there. And when she got the surgery and the doctor looked at what was going on, the doctor said, you would have probably died without having the surgery, in this week or in this month. And that was a year after she had originally been diagnosed.
So I don't know if you've been able to do this, but can you compare Medi-Cal reimbursement rates with other states?
Yeah. So California's Medi-Cal reimbursement rate is 48th out of 50 in the country. Huh. So 48th lowest.
Yeah.
And that, just for sort of comparison, what we pay doctors under Medi-Cal is about half of what they get under Medicare. So it's a dramatic difference.
So it seems that they would have a point at least on that score in terms of the reimbursement rates.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would argue that Medi-Cal reimbursement rates aren't low. I think the question is, how do we fix that problem? Where does the money come from? And those sorts of things. And Governor Braun actually approved a $465 million increase to go towards doctor payments in this recent budget. But that's a really small amount considering how many people are in Medi-Cal and how many doctors there are. So it's not going to fundamentally fix this problem.
So Mia Carlamangla covers health and healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you. If you are a Medi-Cal user, how do you find the system? Are you frustrated with it, or are you finding it okay, finding doctors and the care okay? You can get in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee sent a letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions yesterday. They want to know why the Justice Department suddenly decided to settle a major money laundering case 2 days before it was to go to trial in New York. The defendant in that case is represented by Russian attorney Natalia Veselnitskaya. She, of course, is the attorney who met with Donald Trump Jr. last year, promising information on the Hillary Clinton campaign. Jeff Feely is a legal reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's been covering this. Hi.
How you doing?
Great, thanks. Well, first, tell us about this case. What's it about?
This was a civil forfeiture case brought by the former U.S. attorney in New York, Mr. Bejara. They were going after some properties that had been bought with money that had been traced back to a Russian tax fraud scam, and the company that had owned these properties was Trebizond Holdings, which is owned by Denis Katsayev, the son of a prominent Russian transportation minister in Moscow.
Tax fraud in Russia?
Correct.
Okay, so this money, and I think it was over $200 million, right, was then invested?
$230 million.
Okay, so this was invested in New York City real estate?
Yes, it was invested in four condominiums in downtown New York. It was traced back to this, the money it was used to buy them was traced back to this fraudulent money.
Okay. And so the lawyer in this case is Natalia Veselnitskaya.
Yeah, she was one of the lawyers for Katsayev. She was basically his Russian lawyer. He had a whole team of American lawyers, but she was kind of his main Russian lawyer.
And when was the case, when did Jeff Sessions decide to settle this case?
Well, the case was set for trial on a Monday in May, and on Friday, late Friday night, about 7 p.m. Eastern time, sent out a press release that they had settled the case. They had settled the case for $6 million, and both sides were quick to claim victory. The government said that it was a multiple of how much money had been spent on the condominiums, And the Katsayev's lawyer said that it was so low that it was the equivalent of an apology by the government to Katsayev.
Hmm. And so these House Democrats, they want to know if there's any connection between the settlement and this meeting between Veselnitskaya and Donald Trump Jr.?
Well, the suspicion is that Ms. Veselnitskaya was in New York to attend a hearing in the Prevezon case when she actually met with Donald Trump Jr. And the folks in the House are interested in finding out what, you know, what drove the motivation for settling the case for $6 million. There's obviously some question about whether or not this was tied to, you know, the sprawling entanglements between the Trump family and Russia. And so, you know, I guess the folks on that committee are really interested in probing to see whether those entanglements had anything to do with this settlement.
Okay. And then separately, there's also the Magnitsky Act. And so we've heard a lot about that in recent days, that she wanted to talk about that and possibly get that overturned. This is the act that sanctions people, Russians, who are accused of human rights violations. So how is that tied into this case?
Yeah, this is a little complicated. The tax fraud, the $230 million fraudulent tax refund, came from a scheme that targeted William Browder, who is a hedge fund guy who was the largest hedge fund guy in Russia at one point. And it was his companies that were targeted in this tax fraud scheme. He had hired Magnitsky to investigate who perpetrated the scheme. And while Magnitsky was investigating in Russia, he was arrested and thrown into jail and then later died in jail. The Russian government said he died of heart failure. Browder says he was beaten to death. So his death is what sparked passage of the so-called Magnitsky Act, which was sanctions against some of the people that the Congress believed were involved in Magnitsky's death. And that basically put a travel ban on those folks. This has enraged the Russians, who believe that, you know, Browder is basically the one who pulled the tax scam and has been, you know, manipulating everything behind the scenes. And so they have drawn a red line on this law and been, you know, gone after it with all guns that they can. So that's why Ms. Veselnitskaya was, you know, over here lobbying people about what a bad law this is, because that's a real thorn in the side of the Russians.
But does that law directly affect her clients in this case?
It does not, other than her clients in this case were accused of using money tied to the fraud that Magnitsky's death was linked to.
Mm-hmm. So Bill Browder's money, in effect.
Correct.
Okay, so what does Bill Browder make of all of this that's happened with this news that Donald Trump Jr. met with Veselnitskaya and just the connection to this case and to him?
I haven't had a chance to talk to him personally since this broke, but I know that Mr. Browder would be very interested to find out whether or not, you know, there are any ties from Ms. Veselnitskaya to this settlement. You know, Mr. Browder is clearly somebody who would like to have people held accountable for the death of Mr. Magnitsky, who was his lawyer and his friend. So if this lawyer somehow tied in with that entire thing, he'd absolutely love to have her, you know, testify before Congress.
And then, sort of a side note, Magnitsky's family hired an attorney to look into his death, and that attorney recently fell out of a window in his Moscow apartment.
Or was pushed, depending on who you believe.
But he survived, so...
Correct. Correct.
This sounds
like... There was another whistleblower involved in the Magnitsky case who came forward with... documents showing, you know, who may have been involved in the fraud. He died under suspicious circumstances in London a couple of years ago of a very exotic poison.
Wow. Okay. And so I guess, is the Justice Department, has it responded at all to this letter? I guess it's early. This letter was just sent yesterday.
I can almost hear the response now that they made a decision to settle a case based on the facts of the case. It had nothing to do with Ms. Veselnitskaya, Mr. Trump, Mr. Trump Jr., any of that stuff.
All right. Well, thank you so much for I guess, clearing this up or raising more questions. I don't know, but it's fascinating.
I'm not sure anybody will be able to ever clear this up. This is one of those cases that has a million tentacles that, you know, are still waving around.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking about it. Jeff Feely, legal reporter for Bloomberg News. Coming up on the program, the Emmy nominations are out. We'll have the highlights next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Emmy nominations were announced this morning, and we know one thing for sure. You will not hear this theme over and over again at this year's awards ceremony. Game of Thrones, not eligible for Emmys this year. It missed the eligibility period. So, with the White Walkers and Dragons sidelined, is it safe for some other shows to take the spotlight? Michael Schneider is here. He is executive editor at IndieWire, editor at large at Variety, and host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi.
Hello, hello.
Yeah. And an Emmy winner yourself. You should add that to your list.
Exactly. Emmy Award winning journalist. I don't know. There are so many categories these days. Maybe we should add that in.
Well, but, I think we should.
But yeah, it's an interesting year because, as you mentioned, Game of Thrones not in the mix, but that didn't matter to HBO in the end. They killed it this year. 111 nominations.
They're
up
the most
from last
nominated.
Year. Most nominated in a long time, and the most of any network this year, with Netflix close behind with 91, which is also a huge haul. They're up from 56 last year, so they had a big year as well.
So HBO has Westworld, which received 22 nominations. Was that a surprise to you?
That was a surprise. I mean, it was a prestige show. It generally got pretty good reviews, but it was on last fall, and these days, that's sort of an afterthought at this point. There was so much great content at the beginning of this year, and in April, a lot of the networks really just loaded up their lineups because they wanted to be front and center in top of mind for Emmy voters. So the fact that Westworld did so well is a testament to HBO's prowess when it comes to just campaigning for these awards.
Okay, let's talk about Netflix. As you mentioned, they are second in the hall this year. And what are some of the nominees there?
Well, they did very well with The Crown. Also, Master of None did very well for them. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on the comedy side. On the drama side, I mentioned The Crown, but also Stranger Things did very well. That's another show that actually was on a while ago, but it was such a pop culture phenomenon that voters really gravitated toward it.
Okay, so any surprises in the drama acting categories?
Not a ton. There's always the ones that you're disappointed not to see. For example, No One from The Leftovers. That's a show that critically was really acclaimed. People were really talking about it, and unfortunately,
and not
Justin,
nominated in
not,
drama.
Not nominated for much of anything, to tell you the truth. So that was sort of a big disappointment. But otherwise, you know, when you go down the list of nominees, Claire Foy from The Crown, Sterling K. Brown from This Is Us, which is another big story, a big year for that show, brand new. Anthony Hopkins from Westworld, Bob Odenkirk from Better Call Saul. It's kind of a list that you would expect. The House of Cards folks are back. Mm-hmm. That's a show that's perennial with voters. So, nothing that you can really, really say was a bad choice.
Okay, let's move on to comedy and Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Veep, as Selena Meyer. I want to just play a clip of her from last season.
If I do win, I will have my administration come to your little district and shake it to death like a Guatemalan nanny. And then I'm going to have the IRS crawl so far up your husband's colon, he's going to wish the only thing they find is more cancer.
Oh my gosh. So she has won a lot.
She has won 5 in a row, and she's about to win her 6th. Let's just put it on the table right now. She is a shoo-in to win. And if she does, she will break the record books. That'll be the most wins of any person ever playing the same character, beating out, I believe she's now in a 3-way tie with Murphy Brown with Candace Bergen and Don Knotts from Andy Griffith's show, who they've all won 5 over the years for playing the same role. She will win her 6th this year, I believe, and then that'll go in the history books.
Okay, speaking of comedy, Saturday Night Live tied Westworld with 22 nominations, no doubt helped along by the election and skits like this.
Now I'd like to begin today by apologizing on behalf of you to me for how you have treated me these last 2 weeks. And that apology is not accepted. Because I'm not here to be your buddy. I'm here to swallow gum, and I'm here to take names.
Okay, that's Melissa McCarthy as Sean Spicer, yeah. Nominated for Best Guest Actress in a Comedy.
Yeah, and Alec Baldwin also nominated, of course, for hosting, but also, of course, playing the president. And, you know, SNL coming off such a huge season. Ratings are up, critical acclaim, and also breaking the history books. It got 22 nominations this year, which is the most ever for a variety series. So again, for a show that's been on the air for, you know, over 40 years, that's pretty incredible.
And what are the shows in comedy?
So comedy-wise, let me find that up. Master of None, like I mentioned, Aziz Ansari, which is fantastic. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Silicon Valley, Black-ish, which is the other great broadcast hope besides This Is Us. There aren't many broadcast shows nominated these days. That's one of the few. And Modern Family, which is a show that used to win perennially, but doesn't anymore because Veep is on that list, and Veep's been winning the past couple of years. So I think Veep is a shoe-in this year.
And also Donald Glover from Atlanta nominated.
Donald Glover nominated not only for Atlanta, but also for writing Atlanta and for directing Atlanta. That guy's a triple threat. He's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Okay, so there are several reality TV categories, and a show to watch out for this year is...
The time has come for you to lip sync for your life. Good luck, and don't it up.
His signature line there. So nominated again, another win.
RuPaul's Drag Race. This is actually a big year for RuPaul. The show moved to VH1 and it's gotten more acclaim than ever. RuPaul is nominated in the host category, and RuPaul's Drag Race for the first time nominated in reality competition program, where it goes up against Amazing Race, American Ninja Warrior, Top Chef, The Voice, and Project Runway. So, by the way, that the host category, I love this category because it's got such an interesting mix of people. Snoop Dogg. And,
really?
And Martha Stewart are also up for host. They do a show called Martha and Snoop's Potluck Dinner Party. But so RuPaul's up against them, Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn from Project Runway, Alec Baldwin for The Match Game. This is an eclectic mix. Kamau Bell, who does a great show on CNN, and Gordon Ramsay. So I think you've got kind of like the cross-section of reality right there. I love that category. Well, that may be my favorite category.
How do you handicap that?
I want to give them all an Emmy. I want Snoop Dogg up on stage, honestly, the night of the Emmys.
Him up with RuPaul.
Yes,
together.
Yes. And Martha Stewart and Gordon Ramsay yelling at all of them. That would be the perfect
might be on his best behavior.
Yeah.
He might.
We'll see. But that's my dream, is that they all win. It's a 5-way tie.
All right. So snubs.
Yeah, so snubs, like I mentioned, The Leftovers. I mean, there are so many snubs. The problem with the snubs is that ultimately there's only 7 nominees per category, and we're living in an age, as we've talked about many times in the past, of 500 scripted series. So ultimately that means only 4% of all the scripted series ultimately can even be nominated in these categories. So name a show, and it's going to be a snub for the most part. The Good Fight, which was the spinoff of The Good Wife. I mean, the list goes on and on. The Gilmore Girls reboot that came back didn't get any nominations. If you think of a show, for the most part, it probably didn't get many nominations or any at all.
Jimmy Fallon, not nominated.
Jimmy Fallon, not nominated.
Maybe not so surprising.
Not so surprising, partly because obviously it is the Trump factor, and this year with Full Frontal with Samantha Bee being nominated, and the Late Show with Stephen Colbert being nominated, the shows that had a little bit more of a political bent had great years and were noticed by the Academy.
And what about The Americans, Transparent, the last season of Girls?
Transparent's another big snub. That's a show that, you know, has always straddled comedy and drama. It's been traditionally nominated in comedy. And I think ultimately the problem is when you're looking at some really funny shows, and that's a show that's been on the air for a couple seasons now, it's much easier to sort of put it by the wayside. Jeffrey Tambor is still fantastic in that show, still nominated. But, you know, you got to make some room for some new shows.
Okay. And I guess we'll see what happens in when? September? Is that when?
Yeah. Okay. September 19th. September 19th. Stay tuned.
We will stay tuned. Michael Schneider, executive editor at IndieWire and editor at large at Variety and host of KCRW's The Spinoff and Emmy Award winning.
One day, Madeline.
Radio commentator. Thank you so much. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the shows nominated? Did the Academy miss one of your favorites? Do you even care about this at all? You can comment on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Chasing Coral, a new documentary about the Earth's vanishing coral reefs.
We captured reefs flat out dying. They went past the stage, that white stage where they are bleached, and they went fully to death.
A film crew races to document what's happening before it's too late. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Coral reefs are beautiful, and snorkeling or scuba diving around them is an amazing experience, all those tropical fish darting in and out of the coral. But coral is more important than just a vacation highlight. The reefs support a quarter of all ocean life, and that ocean life supports millions and millions of people. It might not be long, though, before the world's coral reefs are gone. They're disappearing at an alarming rate. Just last year, a third of Australia's Great Barrier Reef died, and that's the equivalent distance of Washington, D.C. to Maine. The cause of this? Climate change and ocean warming. But for a crisis of this magnitude, the response has been underwhelming.
One of the biggest issues with the ocean is it is completely out of sight and out of mind, and that essentially is an advertising issue.
Well, that's advertising executive turned conservationist Richard Vevers. He's one of the subjects of a new documentary called Chasing Coral. The film documents his effort to document the death of the Earth's coral reefs in a way that will grab our attention before it's too late. Chasing Coral was directed by Jeff Orlowski. He directed a previous documentary about glaciers affected by climate change called Chasing Ice. Jeff Orlowski, welcome to Press Play.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, first a primer. Corals, they're not plants per se. They're actually animals.
Yes.
Can you just describe what they are?
I knew very little about this before working on this project. They are an animal that actually has these little plants living in them, and the plants basically feed them. Imagine having solar panels in your skin that could somehow feed you. Like, that's sort of the equivalent of what's going on with corals. And as they grow, they then deposit a rock. And that rock continues to grow, and it makes these structures that is the entire backbone of a coral reef. It is the infrastructure for a coral reef, and they can grow to be the size of the Great Barrier Reef, and they can be seen from space. Hmm. It's this really impressive, it's a simple, simple organism that can do this incredible thing and grow to this incredible size.
Let me play a clip of tape from your movie, and here are a couple of marine scientists describing corals.
Think of a city. Corals are experts at creating high-rises. They're basically creating this incredible dimensionality, this three-dimensional framework. The more complex a structure, the more biodiversity can potentially live there.
You look at the Great Barrier Reef, it's really the Manhattan of the ocean.
Wow. Okay, so we're seeing the Manhattan of the ocean dying off. How fast are the coral reefs disappearing?
It is startling. It is honestly, it's very mind-blowing to see how fast they're changing. It far exceeded our expectations. We spent 4 months in Australia last year trying to document this, and there were some reefs in particular that we went to where we saw them going from a healthy or stressed state to completely dead in a matter of 2 months. And let me explain just a hint of the science. Corals can only exist up to a certain temperature. I mean, all animals on the planet have a temperature range they can live in. And corals have a very, very limited temperature range that they're optimized for. And what we're finding is that as the ocean gets warmer and warmer, the summer temperatures are getting hotter and hotter, and they're pushing corals beyond their threshold, beyond their limit. So imagine your body temperature. Right now, you're sitting, it's 98.6 degrees, give or take a little bit. Imagine your body temperature went up a couple of degrees, and now you have a 102 degree fever, and you're sustained like that for a couple of weeks. That is effectively what's happening to coral reefs. They're getting pushed constantly all around the planet beyond their temperature tolerance. And just briefly, when the oceans are getting, as they're getting hotter, if the water temperature passes a certain threshold, the corals effectively get sick. They spit out the plant that also gives them the color that's in their flesh. And in that process, they turn white. And so we started seeing a couple decades ago, and it's becoming more and more common, for sections of corals to turn white. And so that's what we were trying to capture at the beginning of this project about 3 or 4 years ago. By the end of it, it far exceeded what we thought we were going to capture. We captured reefs flat out dying. They went past the stage, that white stage where they are bleached, and they went fully to death.
Oh, my gosh. So we've known about coral bleaching. And is there a point where, all right, so the coral is bleached and there's an opportunity for it to go back to being healthy?
Yeah.
Or once it's bleached, that's the beginning of the end?
No, when a coral bleaches, it's just like a person getting sick, or maybe you can think of it as a person in a coma. If the temperature drops, if the temperature comes back down, the corals can recover. And we've seen that in the past. We've seen areas come back from a big bleaching event. The concern that the scientists have is that based on the trends in ocean warming, these events are going to come more and more frequently. In the past, they only really happened on big El Niños. So in big El Niño cycles where there was this extreme shift in ocean temperatures from the El Niño, that's when we saw bleachings that happened in the 90s and in the 2000s. But now, in the last couple of years, we've started into a new phase where you don't even need El Niños any longer to have a bleaching event. And that's really one of the startling things.
Okay, so Richard Vevers, this former advertising executive, he thinks this is a huge problem that needs a lot of attention. And so he hires you and your crew to basically document him documenting. How did that work?
Sure. Well, he didn't hire us. Richard just reached out to our team and told us what was going on. And we started following him. We started to explore what a film production would look like, what a documentary could look like. We were figuring out, there were so many issues affecting the oceans. We were trying to figure out what story was the best story to tell. And it was at that stage where Richard kept finding places that were being affected by this phenomenon, and we just kept filming him. And that's when we realized if we worked together, we could build these new cameras, these time-lapse cameras, to try to document that change over time and hopefully provide the visual story that an audience can sit back and watch and understand, oh, now I get what's going on. And hopefully the pictures can help do the talking.
Which is what you did with your previous film, Chasing Ice.
Yeah, in Chasing Ice, it was a very similar approach. The subject of that film, James Balog, wanted to do time lapses of glaciers. And between the two of these films, we've figured out this way to capture the science and to be a translator for the science, to be able to visualize what the science community has known so for so many years.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jeff Orlowski about his new documentary. It's called Chasing Coral. So after you encounter some technical difficulties with the cameras that were set up to shoot automatically, you decide to shoot manually, and you and your crew really go through an arduous process over several months to document a bleaching event. And what was that like? And describe the process, if you could, of going down there day after day to the same spot and filming.
Absolutely. I don't want to spoil too much of the film, but there was a point where the only way we could capture this was by doing it manually, by going back to the same site, putting markers in the sand, and getting the camera into the same exact position to repeat the same shot. And if you think about it, on land, it's not a huge challenge to put a camera in the same position every day. When you're doing this underwater while scuba diving, while being tossed around by the waves, by the surge, with a floor that is constantly changing as the sand shifts every single day, it becomes really challenging to get the shots well enough aligned that you can actually make a time lapse out of it. So our team, Zach Rago, one of the subjects, he and I spent time on one particular island with some crew. We had another team on another island doing this process day in and day out for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, all for the objective of capturing those changes over time.
Now, you mentioned Zach. He is quite a coral aficionado, obsessive, one might say. And he does a lot of the filming. He describes what it's like witnessing this devastation, and he himself is emotionally devastated. And here's a clip from your movie.
You forget what it looked like at the beginning. And some days when you go back and you're sitting down there looking at it now, and it doesn't look real. You can't even accept it. And then you open your eyes and it's dead as far as you can see.
So was it really emotionally difficult for you to film this?
Yes. It's interesting here, just hearing that clip now just sort of put me back in that mental space of seeing it last year. We watched a slow motion underwater catastrophe. Like, we were watching firsthand this entire ecosystem die in front of our eyes. I don't know how to articulate it to communicate what that felt like. And for Zach in particular, this ecosystem is one that he loves more than anything else. He grew up in Colorado and worked in a coral aquarium shop growing corals and studying corals, being obsessed with corals. And for him to be out there on the Great Barrier Reef for the first time and to see the most beautiful coral reef he's ever seen and to watch that go through this daily demise and breaking apart, It was very challenging. It was challenging for both of us, but I would certainly say even more so for Zach. You know, it's funny. I got into this field of work, into this line of work, because I wanted to go on adventures. I wanted to go see the planet and see its beauty. And when we first started making Chasing Ice, I got to go to Iceland and go to Greenland and go to these far-off remote places. And between these two projects now, the job doesn't feel as fun as I once thought it would be, because we're on the front lines of watching parts of the planet fall apart, and coral reefs are in such a state of peril right now. It's hard, like they've been on the planet for hundreds of millions of years, and they might actually completely disappear within the next 30 years or so. When I say completely disappear, like, we're talking about reefs as we know them today will not exist like they are today in the next 25 or 30 years. And the only way to keep them and to preserve them at this stage is with massive human intervention.
Yeah, let me play a clip of tape from one of your biologists in the movie. Her name is Ruth Gates.
Coral reefs will not be able to keep up. They will not be able to adapt. And we will see the eradication of an entire ecosystem in our lifespan. That is a very gloomy statement, but unfortunately it is true.
So, Jeff, when you hear that very gloomy assessment, what do you think in terms of the ability to turn this around in time?
Yeah, the future is pretty bleak for coral reefs, and Ruth's comment there It is gloomy, but and it's something that it's taken me now a few years to go through and process. Can we save them? Yes, absolutely. It's going to take a lot of work. And that's what Richard, one of the subjects in our film, Richard is working on this project right now called 50 Reefs, where he and a team of scientists are trying to identify which reefs around the planet are the most resilient, are the most likely to survive the next two or three decades. And if we can identify those reefs that are most likely to survive, can we then put all of our effort into preserving them? And then if we can get climate change under control, these reefs can then reseed the ocean. Can we selectively breed corals to make them more resilient to temperature and to acidity? That's the current level of the science right now, is figuring out, it's effectively like a Hail Mary pass for coral reefs.
Oh. Is it possible to make the ocean cooler around these reefs?
That is another question. I sort of was joking. This ice, you know, iceberg that just broke off of Larsen C, let's just tow that up to the Great Barrier Reef and let it cool off
thing.
All the air. Like, that sounds
like a
awesome.
Big ice cube.
It really is a question of geoengineering that scientists are talking through. There are a variety of ways that you could cool off a coral reef. You can shade them. I know scientists who are working on studying, can you seed clouds over the Great Barrier Reef to keep it covered in clouds to minimize the heat stress during the peak summer months? So all of that said, like, there is a very sobering reality out there, but we can solve this.
Jeff Orlowski, he's the director of Chasing Coral. The movie opens in theaters in L.A. tomorrow. It'll also premiere on Netflix tomorrow. And you can see some of the devastation of these reefs now. We have photos from Chasing Coral. You can check it out on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up. You know those ransomware emails some people are getting? Pay a ransom or your personal data could be made public or your computer could be scrubbed. Shani Jardin is here to tell us what to do if you become a target. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The newspaper business has a love-hate relationship with Facebook and Google. That's to put it mildly. News outlets need those tech giants to get their stories in front of as many eyeballs as possible. However, Google and Facebook also soak up the bulk of the revenue, the online ad revenue. Well, a group of papers now wants to band together to negotiate a better deal. They will need permission from Congress, though. We're going to talk about that and also what you can do to protect yourself against ransomware with Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular Thursday tech guru.
Hey, Madeline. It's
Hi.
Good to be back.
It's nice
in
to
the
see
internet
you.
Hot seat.
Yes, Doo-doo. You are. Get your guns out.
All right.
Okay, so let's talk about what the newspapers want Congress to do.
Yes. So this industry trade group called the News Media Alliance, the Los Angeles Times parent company, Tronc, is one of the members, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and a number of smaller regional newspapers around the country. All of these news organizations are essentially banding together in common cause to ask lawmakers to loosen up the antitrust laws to allow the newspapers to collectively bargain with the likes of Facebook and Google. Facebook, as we've talked about here on Press Play many times, more than half of the country sees Facebook as their primary news source. And if you think about how that changes the power dynamic in terms of information, we can see what a big role that played, let's say, in this last election. But we can also think about what a big power dynamic change that is in business. So When I go to look at the Los Angeles Times, I see lots of different advertisements. Some of them might be sold by the LA Times' own internal ad staff. And I don't know exactly how the LA Times works, but some of a newspaper's ads are also coming. They're like bulk ads, if you will, through Google. And if a newspaper wants for its content to be reachable through Facebook, and everybody does because everybody's getting their news that way, they're sort of at the mercy of how Facebook runs its own in-network ads.
And they are not allowed to get together as it is under current law to collectively bargain. They each have to strike their own separate deals with Facebook?
Yes, that's right. And if you think about the kind of leverage that, you know, a tiny little local paper might have against two companies that command over 70% of the 73 billion digital industry in the U.S., like, they don't have a chance.
Yeah.
They don't have a chance.
So what's Congress likely to do?
I don't know what exactly will happen, but the argument from the News Alliance is this. The selective or loose way that antitrust law has been applied over the last 10, 20 years towards companies like Facebook and Google have allowed those ad brokers to become ad monsters. They have an effective monopoly over online advertising. I should mention, too, Boing Boing, the company that I'm a partner in, we play this same game. So it's a race I have a horse in.
Yeah.
But my horse is very tiny. So the idea is that if American government loosened things up to encourage the tech industry to grow as big as it could, and these two companies hit the jackpot, then maybe it's time to apply that same kind of flexibility and encouragement and a practical application of that law to let these newspapers, which are losing tons and tons and tons of revenue.
Well, you know, another thing is we can all pay for a newspaper subscription.
We can, but do we?
No, but I'm saying, hello, we can.
Yeah.
And we don't. We like to get our news for free on Facebook or wherever.
Yeah, so maybe.
So.
Well, but and hoping to change human behavior is not an effective business strategy.
Right.
You know, it's just not. So apart from every newspaper, KCRW is not part of this story, but apart from every newspaper being able to effectively beg people to subscribe, they this got is, nothing yeah. except declining revenues
right.
unless something like this happens. I hope they work it out. I don't have a position in it per se, but I think it's a good idea for us to save news. I think news really matters.
Let's just start with that basic point. News matters.
Yeah.
I would probably argue anyone listening to this would agree, since they're listening.
Yeah.
Okay, let's switch gears now and talk about ransomware. And the reason why I wanted you to address this is because I was talking to a friend of mine and her dad received a ransomware note. He ignored it. And then his computer was wiped clean.
Wow.
And that was the first time I had heard of that happening to a civilian. So how common is this, that just a regular person gets a ransomware note and then is asked to pay up?
Well, you know, regular people were caught up in some of those very big ransomware and malware attacks that we talked about here on the show recently, like Petya and WannaCry. For those who aren't familiar, ransomware is means basically ransom plus software. So the idea is that somebody, bad guys, criminals, either looking to disrupt systems or looking to get cash, create applications and then try to get you to download them or engage with them over the web by tricking you into thinking, oh, it's just a note from your phone carrier, or it's an email from your auntie who's in your contacts list. You click on that benign thing and you end up sharing keys to your information, a password, a security code, a two-factor authentication, and the bad guys get access to your computer. There are many different forms of ransomware. The scariest ones usually look like text on a black background, just like in the hacker stock photos, right? Well, there's some logic to that. So these scary-looking text things take over your screen, and they say, you know, send a gajillion bitcoins to this address in Ukraine, or we're going to wipe out everything. There are other kinds of ransomware that appear like a virus checking software. And I mention this because depending on the kind of ransomware, sometimes with some savvy help, you can get some of your data back. And sometimes that means, let's say, taking it to a data recovery professional and getting them to access the root directories in a mm-hmm. way that you might not know. But the bottom line is this. The best way to prevent being the victim of a ransomware attack is to be very skeptical and very cautious about email. Even if you see an email message, a Twitter DM, a Skype message, a Facebook message from somebody who appears from an account name or an icon that you appear to know, that may not actually be them. It could be a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Another thing to do is always keep updating your operating systems, especially, you know, we all know somebody who's still running Windows XP somewhere. Yeah. Even Microsoft just said this week, please kill it with fire, upgrade to a more recent version that includes protections against malware.
And I guess you should back up your computer if you can.
And this was the third suggestion. Always back up a complete copy of your data somewhere else in a way that you can access it without your computer. You get what I'm saying?
On the cloud.
You know, backing up a copy on the cloud somewhere is okay if you could access it using a different account than the one was hacked. And it's also good, yes, to have a physical copy in another place. There's a million different things that you can do. The one thing that I would recommend that you not do is pay the ransomware. In many cases, when people do pay these sums, and they can be very, very large sums, they get nothing in return. So you
and will they wipe your computer anyway?
Yes.
Even after you've paid?
Wiping your computer can mean a lot of different things, but they could do everything from destroy your data to encrypting it and making it impossible. There's different things that they could do. Bottom line, if somebody is the victim of ransomware already, paying the criminals behind that is not likely to solve your situation. Another thing, a final note, call authorities. You know, because you may
you
be
mean
the
like
tip.
The FBI. Don't take that meeting. Okay, we got to end it there.
Okay.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net and our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Madeline.
Okay, calling Christian Bordahl right now.
Hello there, Madeline Brand.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I've got one quick correction to make before we get to the feedback. Schneider, earlier when we were talking about the Emmys, you were talking about the Emmys, he said they were happening on September the 19th. He was 2 days off. Stephen Colbert is actually hosting the Emmys live on Sunday, September the 17th, 5 p.m.
Okay.
But you and Michael were absolutely accurate when you said that Julia Louis-Dreyfus is up for winning Best Actress in a Comedy for the sixth year in a row.
And deservedly so, I will say.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite shows.
Well, that seems to be Michael's idea, too. He said she was a shoo-in. We asked whether people agree. The real Levin Stapp said she did Free Tibet. So that's something.
That's an inside joke from the show.
For those who don't watch it. And we also asked, what is the funniest show on TV these days? Gustavo Reyes said the funniest thing has to be Rick and Morty. It's not a show that I've watched. Do you know that one?
No, I don't.
I don't either. Gina Pollack, our own Gina Pollack, says Insecure.
Oh, yes. That's a good one, too. I watched that one.
Finally, you were just talking about ransomware and people's computers getting hacked. And all the craziness around that. Steve tweeted in, it used to be that you just used OS X, the Mac operating system, instead of going on Windows and you'd be fine, but now it's gotten almost as bad on both operating systems, so no one is safe in the world of hackers and ransomware these days.
I was 10. The X. Okay, thank you very much, Christian Bordahl. And that's it for us today. I'm Madeline Bram. I'll see you tomorrow.